couple of the anecdotes and experience and solutions I talk about today are my own professional experiences and my own professional opinions, and not necessarily the opinions of my current employer or past employers.
All someone needs is a point of entry. Where they go after that, or what harm they can do, isn't limited to the place they entered. So a customer could be hurt, a supplier could be hurt, a partner could be hurt. And in terms of a security posture, security practices, parties realize we're different organizations, but the more we link up digitally, to go back to your point about digital everything, the more we connect digitally, the more we're mutually exposed, and we need to be mutually protected.
Totally. And not only that, but, you know, some of the digital tools that we have not only become used to, but can't imagine life without
right?
Are absolutely the things that we need to divest ourselves of. You know, over 74%, and no matter what statistics I look at, I've never seen below 74%, but 74% or above of successful cyber attacks originate with an email, be it a phishing email, or it could be any form of social engineering. It could be an executive spoof that allows them that entry point that you mentioned. And then once in, they do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Bad guys are not stupid.
Yeah.
Bad guys are not lazy. They are, in fact, pretty brilliant people. They're intelligent. They have a passion for this. They have the same aptitude and affinity for technology and their chosen career path that I wish more and more young people had for cybersecurity. They're really highly motivated, and they, you know, sometimes it's just sport to them.
Right.
But the damage that they can do is pretty drastic.
Yeah, it is.
And one needs to look no further than the MITRE ATT&CK. ATT&CK stands for adversarial tactics, techniques, and common knowledge. But the MITRE ATT&CK defines all of the tactics and techniques, and you can even use it to see, you know, which type of attacks, be they ransomware or a phishing attack, or they're trying to exfiltrate data or get credit card numbers or something. Literally any attack that you could think of, and MITRE can show you which tactics and techniques are used to pull it off.
Yeah.
You know, this is through how they embed,
how
they move laterally, how they go download, they find opportunities and lapses in technical configuration in order to go download more malware or to set up a beaconing site and to communicate sensitive and secret and confidential data back to a C2 server. So, you know, they really are good at what they do. They are not playing games, even if to them the fun of it's just sport. Looking to make money doing it. We don't ever underestimate what they can do. Mm-hmm. So your point about that first entry point being, you know, the point where now you can double face palm and just shake your head. it is that initial entry point. And that's what a lot of information security teams focus primarily on. We need to stop the initial attack. We need to stop the vector.
Well, and the other approach is assume they're in, right?
Always.
Assume they're inside.
Encrypt on the inside too, because if they're not there now, they could be, and you don't need to go figuring out who to point fingers at for whose fault it is. It is because they are very good at their job, and they run their companies like Fortune 100, Fortune 50.
That's fascinating.
They're not like a loose group of dudes that just know each other.
Yeah, right. Right. Working out of their grip basement.
You know, part of the crisis in cybersecurity is the lack of people with experience. And I don't know if you've heard in the news, there's a lot of concern right now throughout the world, not just the country, in terms of we have a lot of people. In fact, there's an abundance of people with degrees in IT, degrees in, believe it or not, information security, which is available now, and masters in, mm-hmm. you know, cyber security or cryptography or whatever their, you know, area is. But companies aren't ready yet to get back on board with what works so successfully to build this country, and that is apprenticeship style relationships. And, you know, in one of your podcasts, there was some discussion of TQM, as a fact, you brought it up. And I have experience with that, too, when I was younger. And while I don't disagree with anything, I saw the reaction of the coworkers, especially the guys who were 10 and 20 years older than I was, as to this is another program without teeth. But at the same time, I got lucky enough to have some people who were 10 and 20 years older than me. And without even discussing it, we kind of got into this mentorship situation.
Interesting.
And I really feel like if there are good characteristics to my work nowadays, to my ability to relate to people nowadays, to the diligence that I put towards, you know, delivering in order to satisfy not just what the requirement was, but, you know, for the whole team. It came from some, you know, good advice, good guidance. And it even started in college where some of the older students would, you know, show me, hey, you can't say things like this. So even in college, I was fortunate enough to be surrounded by upperclassmen and grad students who, because most of the courses that you take your senior year in electrical engineering are in fact master's level courses.
Okay.
And but you're around these older people, and not only do they give you advice that you could not have come by yet, at least not firsthand.
Right.
But you've also learned to trust these people. You've learned, you've seen their success. You see how diligently they work. Now, fast forward, you know, maybe 15, 20, 25 years, and it became really popular for not just in, you know, the federal workspace, but also in private industry, to try and structure mentor and mentee programs. And I don't know how you would gauge success or failure. I'm sure that really positive long-term relationships were developed. But again, it would have been a forced situation. And in fact, the mentor could have been paired up with somebody that, yeah, they can teach them what they know, but they're not really sure how to get to on the same page in terms of this is what this younger individual needs to help sharpen their focus on their career. Well, what do they need to achieve their goals? What do they need to do? Take a step back. What do they need to do to define their goals? How do they even know what they want to accomplish out of a career now?
Right.
And, you know, I had these people around me, and I think a lot of companies did a really good job and a really good thing implementing programs like that. So then you're closing the generation divide a little bit. And at the same time, you're getting back to something that, again, as we made technology progress, even way before the digital age, you had a lot of not just hands-on skills, but, you know, real good professional skills that you would apprentice for years. And you would be learning from somebody equivalent to, let's say, let's call them a master, like a master plumber, something like this. And you got to ask all the questions in the world. And you were looking over their shoulder in the beginning. And then they were looking over your shoulder when you were showing them not only were you paying attention, but you've got this. And it's at that point where you know, they graduate to a role where they can independently perform these services.
You raised an interesting point that I hadn't thought of mentorship, both from the standpoint of some personal goals or objectives, but also more technical mentorship. And some of the best advice I got from people that I worked for, like a direct supervisor, was the mentoring kind of advice. Your comments have made me think about what that meant to me, how valuable it was. And
you might you could easily miss it while it's going on, and you know, a decade or two later, look back and right. see just how important what was gifted to you was to maybe not just your career, maybe right. you know, you're the person that you are. And I think we both know enough about corporate structures and 3 and 5 year plans to know apprenticeships don't seem to make sense, especially to a busy CEO who's got a million other things on his mind and trying to tweak the company to accommodate something is doesn't seem like a big value add at the moment. But the cool thing is it's only slight adjustments yeah. to the organizational model.
I think you're right.
That allow you to start introducing apprenticeship.
I think you're right.
And you can call it whatever you want. And you could even use co-op programs, which I participated in when I was a student in electrical engineering, or internships. You could call it whatever you want. The long and the short of it is you're going to have younger people who come to you with no experience, maybe not even any in IT. I can tell you that I would be able to take those people, and I know a company like the one I'm at right now would be, well, we would know what to do with those people.
Yeah.
We would know. And if you want to see employee loyalty shoot off the charts,
yeah.
do this, because people don't forget who really gave them a chance.
That's right.
People don't forget those who came out and said, I understand where you want to go and I want to help you get there. Because as it is right now, they are typically very sterile transactions of get experience, get your academic education or whatever you require. You fit in, you know, like the models currently show, you fit in this level. You're a level 3 accountant currently,
right.
and we're going to put you here, yeah. and you're going to do this, and then you could either get promoted or you move on. And if you move on, we're 2 weeks out from another cog that fits in your space. And, you know,
that's
true. Very impersonal. I don't think people do it with avarice in mind. I think that is, you know, that's part of the not understanding that we can balance all of these things. We can balance quicker to market and new functionality and cybersecurity and protecting our data and information at the same time. We can also keep the velocity of a sprint team high while bringing in younger people who, like I said, might have zero experience, but darn, they are going to appreciate the opportunity and they're going to make good on it.
Well, and you know, something that's critical to a high functioning team, to a culture of teaming, a culture of collaboration, things that are critical to it go far beyond technical knowledge and skill. So let's take any project where you've got people who know something about the product and service. You've got someone who's from IT or InfoSec, human resources, so finance. A high-functioning team isn't just a compilation of their separate technical subject matter expertise, knowledge, and skill. It's how they work together. And the question of how they work together, which is some of where I got my best, where I was mentored in ways that meant the most to me, that I learned the most from and carried on my life, had to do with more of the human interaction, the communication
right.
skills that you and I are talking about. My first job out of college was in a community mental health center. And it was an amazing job for a lot of reasons. It taught me some things in my 20s that have stayed with me for 40 years. When you are working with severely mentally disabled adults in a community setting, in group homes, you have to be tight as a team. Team wasn't a word, a label. You had to function as a team, because if you didn't, the client suffered. The client paid for it. And we're working 3 shifts, 24/7, 365. So you had to be tight as a team. And I learned as a young professional what that meant. It had to do with collaboration, communication.
I completely agree with that, and I'm glad you brought it up. It has everything to do with their life experience, and which is a good thing, because you want people bringing everything that they are to a job, especially in information security. I have told anyone who will listen, everything you've done, not just jobs, volunteer work, work as a lifeguard, research projects, or playing downstairs in your basement, ripping apart an old computer to see what you can do with it. This is evidence of aptitude and affinity. And everything that somebody brings into a job potentially has value to the entire team and to the enterprise. And you need to be aware, talking to people, let them open up about their past and their history. And let them say things like, "Oh, well, I had this one job and it's irrelevant. It's not even on my resume. It was so stupid," and all these other things. And you hear, because everybody's had either a really bad experience at a job, or wasn't what they expected, wasn't what it was advertised, or they were too young when they were doing it and stuff. I think that that's looking at it improperly. I think that what we really need to do is to let people understand that your capabilities, not just as an employee, but as a human, are the sum total of all these different things and all the different feelings that they've given you and all the different emotional responses and thoughts that go along that are linked intrinsically to these, experiences that you've had. Now, we're going to put you in this situation, and we've gauged, you seem to have an aptitude and affinity towards liking to build things or put them together. Or maybe they're the opposite person. I'd put them on a demo team,
Well,
you know?
what makes it important to InfoSec, the department and the function, to have whole people in there on that team?
It's maybe the most important thing. And the reason is what we do on an InfoSec team, what any cyber professional does for a living, even if they're currently pigeonholed working on cryptography algorithm or something, the entirety of the field is sharing several things. We're all sharing known risks. We're sharing the fact that there are unknown risks. Okay, there are threats out there that we don't know. We're hopefully doing a mature job of risk management. But when people are working, for example, get an alert. So your dashboard fires off an alert, and it looks like there was a suspicious request made into one of your web servers, and you're not sure what happened, but you're going to go check it out. Well, chances are real good that you may have seen something similar, but this one is unique. It has to. This is unique. And it is the affinity towards an investigative nature that drives InfoSec professionals to really think and think deep. What's going on here? What could possibly be going on that I don't see yet? Where should I go next to see if this is getting worse? How far did they get before my dashboard
Lit
alerted
up,
me that something went horribly wrong? How terrified should I be? But we have to have this nature about us through a lot of experience that we've had through all different sorts of jobs and all different sorts of life experience, where when we're responding to an incident or responding to a situation, that we the first thing we think of is there could be a lot more going on here than I'm being informed of, and I need to investigate this, and I'm going to use every last skill I've ever learned in my life and a very curious brain to get to the bottom of it. And even a bulk of people in information security would love to get a score on it when they're done. How did I do?
You said nature of a person. I think that answered my question a lot. So something about the nature of a person will make him or her well qualified for an InfoSec role or less well qualified for an InfoSec role. They might be very well versed in all of the technical aspects of the position, right? But you want someone who's more curious than less curious. You want someone who's more concerned than less concerned. You want someone who can communicate better with others around the enterprise, not just with you. On a spectrum, you want a more well-rounded, like you want a liberal arts major with an InfoSec master's degree.
Do one of the very best, not just programmer, but software integrators I ever got to work with is a political science major. He was never formally trained or diplomated in any of this. He had an aptitude and an affinity, and he drove that.
Very, very interesting. We were talking about the apprenticeship concept and apprenticeship. It's not much of a program anymore. Can it be more of a program? What would be the benefit of having more of a actual apprenticeship program? I did not serve in the military, but you and I both worked with someone who did, Bob Nunnally. And Bob talked could talk in detail about the concept that they lived there, or he did. I suppose some do and some might less so. The succession plan. He could talk in detail about succession planning and what it meant, because so many people in the military rotate into different positions over time that it was incumbent upon leadership to train the next person in their role. Our discussion made me think of comments that Bob had made. If you care about the position and what it means within a team or a unit, you want them to do the best they can. You want them to be as well as prepared by being as well-rounded as they can. You would be thinking and paying attention to the more holistic kinds of things that you talked about earlier when you talked about the whole person, the nature of a person.
I'm glad you brought up Bob Nunnally, one of my favorite people and Americans. Bob Nunnally had the ability to mentor large groups of people without them knowing they were being mentored. And that is a complete highest level compliment that I can pay an individual.
Well,
And everything that he brought was important. Chester Barnard talks a lot about the parallels and the alignment between how the military operates and how businesses can best perform using a lot of those techniques and behaviors. And what Bob would come into an organization and do that a lot of people still today struggle mightily with, and that is transition plans. And I know you have a lot of successes under your belt transitioning large-scale transitions for organizations. And to me, that skill is one that if you can find people who are really interested in all these moving parts and not just getting to be, but what are we going to do to get there? And what are all these challenges that we're going to run into? Somebody who's excited about overcoming challenges, that's a good team member. And I guarantee you that excitement about overcoming challenges came from their past experience. And they actually became passionate about things that were complex or overcomplicated and how to make them simpler.
In another couple of weeks, I'll release an episode where Bob and I spoke. Okay. So
Nice.
watch for that. And Bob and Tom Oates and I are scheduling an episode for the three of us to talk.
Oh, I can't wait. I'll tune in as soon as you do that. I
So
love it.
Bob and I talked a lot. Bob's real big on commander's intent. We talked a lot in our interview about the leadership approach of using commander's intent. But Tom had talked in our interviews, you might remember, about intent-based leadership. And they overlap, but they're slightly different. And so we thought we would do one episode where we would get those two talking together.
Oh, I can't wait. That's going to be good.
I am very interested in the whole risk management concept.
Everybody has cyber concerns right now. The more information that we can share, and it's not just companies. I mean, I do our security orientation briefing every Monday, and it is different every Monday.
Wow.
The slide deck's the same, but you know, we talk about different things, and I'm not in the room with people anymore, which is sad,
right?
Because I used to be able to read micro expressions, and I used to see what type of phone they got, and I used to, and I'd throw out things to help them with their personal online usage.
Right, right.
But as far as companies and CEOs and attracting, you know, top C-suite, risk management really is the cornerstone. That's the foundation. If you have risk management going on right now, well, bravo. I don't understand how you would do without it. You've got to mature your risk management day by day by day. But there's more, because when you start talking about a risk register, if I went to a webinar or a seminar with 1,000 people and I stood up and I said, raise your hand if you don't have a risk register. How many people do you think would say they don't?
None. Right. They want it.
Nobody.
Right.
Everybody's got a risk register.
Yeah.
Question is, what are you doing with it?
Right.
And are you checking it? And are you updating it? And are you using that with the proper language to communicate threats and risks that you're in the language that your C-suite looks at and goes, oh, crap, stop, drop, roll. We need to take care of this now.
Right.
And like, because risk management framework or just your, you know, whatever run of the mill, if you want to stick with SANS or NIST or whatever program you want to implement, risk management is like a serious topic that also solves a lot of problems that companies are dealing with now that they don't know are related to the lack of risk management.
Well, just a quick background. In the last couple of years, I've been rebranding my practice for a while. The pandemic was very disruptive to me. I was on a path, and then I had this shift during the pandemic, and I developed a little bit of pandemic-related material, which were really about having conversations in your company about the matrix of knowns and unknowns, okay?
Right.
And how to have a conversation to convert more knowns, unknowns into knowns, blind spots, biases, whatever it was, and what to do with the information. And you mentioned knowns and unknowns, and my mind went right to that because I'm fascinated by conversations people can have that miss things that are there or catch things that are hidden, right? I love that.
Our original plan was to hold this interview in August of 2020 and to talk about, hey, the pandemic.
Yeah.
You emphasize conversations.
You're right.
It resonated with me so strong that you can ask people. In the summer of 2020, Rick all of a sudden started using the word conversation all the time.
You told me that.
And you know, it's because I believe in it so much and I see results. We've all seen a project and, you know, the outcome is, you know, the people who chartered it and said, yay, verily, this team's going to go produce this. And then something else comes back and you don't even recognize it. Hopefully there's stage gates and controls along the way. But, you know, the lack of conversations and what we lose when we go to digital platforms and digital ways and, you know, remote and internet and all you know, but your original idea, you know, certainly we may be, the ship has already sailed and no one cares. But as far as the pandemic goes, you know, there's an interesting topic for you, and that is with risk management. I've been doing BCP and DR for over 20 years. And I can tell you every time we wrote down global pandemic as a risk, we all smirked, everybody. Oh my God, never gonna happen. Never gonna happen. How could it? We got things under control. But, you know, you could even write a book, What to Expect When You're Not Expecting.
Right,
you know,
because
this is scary. Exactly. But, you know, it really brings risk management into a different focus. And then you could start seeing how these supports of business continuity plan and risk management. Okay, disaster recovery is a different thing, but there are times where all part of BCP, and stuff, and you have incident response and all these other things going on. Hey, that's a whole lot of stuff, and it probably costs a whole lot of money to cobble all that together.
Yeah.
Yes and yes. And the fact of the matter is, while it doesn't ensure that your business plan, we're going to do X and gain revenue, it doesn't ensure that that's going to be successful, but at least the unexpected stuff isn't going to tear down what was a great business and a great business idea.
That's right.
Well, sadly, in a lot of those cases, it was a beautiful corporate culture that now no longer exists because something bad happened that they weren't prepared for or didn't see coming. And right. So I see you, especially with your transition skills and experience, because that's part of it. You know, how do you get your culture into really thinking in terms right. of risk management?
Right.
We're going to do something. Risk. Positive and negative risks. Let's start writing them down and let's go way crazy thinking up ideas.
Rick, this has been a lot of fun and I've learned a lot.
I appreciate you inviting me to do this. This is a great opportunity. It's my passion and my belief in what doesn't work and what does experiences that, hey, if we're not sharing those with our peers, if we're not, you know, forget competition. The businesses are going to do what the businesses do.
Right.
But, you know, sharing our successes, sharing the reasons for our successes, that makes us valuable beyond what we understand with our current value and our current position. And that's what's important to be in a person.
Well, I've enjoyed your passion back to the Ambit days. I still enjoy it today. Thank you so much for your generous time and the thoughts you've shared.
Good talking to you. I'm looking forward to the next time we get a chat.
Me too, always. Thanks, Rick. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye. Take care, Luke.
And that's how we see it, my friends. I want to thank Rick for recording two episodes with me. You can find them at iseewhatyoumean.castos.com, plus all the usual places. Send your questions and suggestions through an app. Subscribe and give me a 5-star rating unless you can't, in which case, tell me why. And join me next week when we take another look at how to get on the same page and stay there, unless you shouldn't.